this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, May 5th, 2026. And here are today's news briefs. Rival ceasefires emerged from Russia and Ukraine. Vladimir Putin called for a two-day truce with Ukraine that would mark this weekend's anniversary of the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany. The Kremlin has already scaled back the traditional military parade on Red Square, which Ukraine has called a legitimate target over fears of drone attacks. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky dismissed the Russian proposal as a theatrical performance and countered with his own plan for an open-ended ceasefire to begin May 6th. There has been no official Russian response, but the defense ministry warned of massive retaliation against Kyiv if Moscow's parade is disrupted. 4:10 p.m. ET staff. The Trump administration will investigate whether Smith College has violated Title IX. The Education Department said it had opened a probe into the Massachusetts Women's College for admitting transgender women and granting them access to women-only spaces, including dormitories, bathrooms, locker rooms, and athletic teams. Women's College ground around the country admit transgender women, and Smith has done so since 2015. In an executive order last year, the Trump administration banned transgender women from participating in college sports, arguing that eligibility is determined according to sex and not gender identity. 4:01 p.m. ET staff. The Cuban government published new migration and citizenship laws. Part of a broader update to the country's legal framework, the regulations replace codes dating to the 1970s and include changes that could strengthen ties with the Cuban diaspora. It's now legal to hold dual citizenship. Several new migratory categories have been created, including humanitarian resident and investors and businesses status, allowing Cubans living abroad to participate in the Cuban economy. The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, whose parents came to the U.S. from Cuba, has demanded that Cuba enact comprehensive political and economic reforms and said the communist nation needs new people in charge. 3:55 p.m. ET staff. A prison set a UK record for inmate employment. At HMP Oakwood in Staffordshire, England, all but seven of the roughly 2,000 inmates are involved in jobs ranging from retail to manufacturing. Prison officials said the work is designed to build skills and prepare inmates for life after release. According to Britain's Ministry of Justice, prison education is linked to about a 10% reduction in recidivism rates. It's a sense of purpose and getting away from prison life, one prisoner told the BBC. 3:48 p.m. ET staff. U.S. says ceasefire with Iran isn't over. The U.S. ceasefire with Iran is still in effect, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Tuesday. Iran has launched cruise missiles, drones, and speedboat attacks on U.S. forces defending commercial ships as part of an effort, dubbed Project Freedom, to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. It's low, harassing fire right now. It feels like Iran is grasping at straws, America's top officer, General Dan Kane, added during the Pentagon briefing. Though these actions remain beneath the threshold of violating the ceasefire, we would urge Iran to be prudent, Secretary Hegseth said. 9:57 a.m. ET staff. The United States pushes to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. military says it fired on Iranian forces and sunk six small boats as it moved to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The United Arab Emirates, a key American ally, said it had come under attack from Iran on Monday, the first since a fragile ceasefire took hold in early April. The attacks appeared to be in response to President Donald Trump's latest efforts to reopen the strategic strait. The U.S. military said two American-flagged merchant ships had successfully transited the strait on Monday. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi warned early Tuesday on X that both the U.S. and the UAE should be wary of being dragged back into the quagmire. 6:50 a.m. ET, Associated Press. Our first article today is why appeals courts are splitting over releasing immigrants on bond, by Cameron Pugh, staff writer, Boston. For nearly 30 years, people arrested by immigration enforcement officials inside the United States could typically live freely as they waited for the results of their immigration cases. Under the Trump administration, officials have tried to keep them locked up as part of its major deportation campaign. The legality of that approach is now hotly contested in federal courts. A Boston-based federal appeals court heard oral arguments in one such case Monday. The case could reverberate across New England and is looking increasingly likely to wind up before the Supreme Court. The class action lawsuit, Guerrero Orlando versus Moniz et al., deals with whether unauthorized immigrants detained by federal officials in the U.S. Interior are entitled to a bond hearing before an immigration judge under federal law. Such hearings determine whether an immigrant can live in the U.S. freely while they fight their deportation, or if they must be jailed until litigation ends. The legality of the Trump administration's policy of detaining everyone arrested by immigration enforcement officials, allowing no bond hearings, is splitting federal appellate courts and may wind up before the Supreme Court. The Trump administration argues that the Immigration and Nationality Act, INA, the nation's primary immigration statute, requires that any unauthorized immigrant detained on U.S. soil must be held without bond. Jose Anulfo Guerrero Oleña, an immigrant from El Salvador who entered the country unlawfully in 2013, argues that the government's position runs contrary to his own long-standing practice and the plain text of the law. Since Congress reformed the INA in 1996, both Republican and Democratic administrations have treated virtually all immigrants detained within the U.S. as eligible for a bond hearing. But last July, the Department of Homeland Security issued a memo reinterpreting that provision, arguing instead that unauthorized immigrants were subject to mandatory detention. The Board of Immigration Appeals, an appellate immigration court that's part of the executive branch, reaffirmed that rule in September. Immigration detentions have surged as the Trump administration pushes its mass deportation agenda. In January of 2025, the government held roughly 40,000 people in immigration detention. A year later, it held more than 68,000 people, a 70% increase, according to an analysis of government data by the American Immigration Council. The number of people held in immigration detention for more than a year increased from 938 at the end of October in 2025 to 2,084 by the end of March in 2026. Public records from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement show. Other cases, like Monday's, have also reached the nation's second-highest courts with mixed outcomes. The Eighth and Fifth Circuit courts sided with the Trump administration earlier this spring. Last week, the New York-based Second Circuit Court ruled against the administration, setting up a split and raising the possibility of Supreme Court review. Monday's oral argument in Boston hinged on several in-the-weeds questions about how to interpret the language of sections 1225 and 1226 of Title VIII of the U.S. Code, which contains immigration law. Traditionally, Section 1225 has dealt with inspection, admission, and detention at ports of entry, while Section 1226 has governed the detention of immigrants already residing in the country, lawfully or not. The sides disagree on whether an applicant for admission, which is defined in the statute as an alien present in the United States who has not been admitted or who arrives in the United States, is the same thing as someone seeking admission. Under Section 1225, an immigrant seeking admission who is not clearly and beyond a doubt entitled to be admitted should be detained while awaiting proceedings. The government argues that the phrases are synonymous. I don't think that seeking admission was supposed to be essentially swallow the definition for applicant for admission, said John Bailey, a lawyer for the Justice Department. Someone who is an applicant for admission is seeking admission. Lawyers for Mr. Guerrero Orellana, by contrast, argue that the two terms are distinct. What the government has done is import into seeking admission the second term, said Adriana LaFail, a lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union. These terms are doing different things. Because Mr. Guerrero Orellana was arrested at a traffic stop in Massachusetts and was not presenting himself to an immigration office official at the border or port of entry at the time, his lawyers argued that he was not seeking admission. In other similar cases over bond hearings, hundreds of district court judges across the country, appointed by both Republicans and Democrats, have by and large agreed with the latter interpretation of the law's language. A district court judge in Massachusetts ruled against the Trump administration in this case last year, setting up the current legal clash. The panel of three judges on Monday asked pointed questions of both sides. Judges Sandra Lynch and Lara Montecalvo repeatedly asked the government to clarify its position on why the statute says seeking admission. Seeking admission seems to require some act on the part of the applicant for admission, Judge Lynch said. If Congress wanted mandatory detention of every applicant for admission, it would be very easy just not to use the phrase at all. Judge Hosea Dunlap asked Ms. LaFalle several times if the ACLU's reading of the law would make parts of the INA superfluous, which judges try to avoid in their rulings. He implied that both parties argued that a statute can use two words to mean one thing. That same argument is what I understand both of you are making, he said. You can use similar terms, not the exact same terms, in the same statute. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has already arrested more than 7,000 people in Massachusetts alone since Mr. Trump's election. WBUR reported almost five times the number arrested in the last 415 days of the Biden administration. The First Circuit's decisions over Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Puerto Rico. Editor's note, this story was updated on the same day of publication to note the portion of the U.S. Code where sections 1225 and 1226 are located. Our next article is on the economy. Congress eyes action on prediction markets amid corruption concerns, by Laurent Belsey, staff writer. Fast-growing prediction markets, where people bet on everything from elections to sports, are facing a regulatory reckoning. This form of gambling can be valuable, studies suggest, because it offers real-time, crowdsourced insights that can help policymakers, central bankers, CEOs, and others make more informed decisions. But recent events are highlighting the prediction market's inherent risks, not least of which are public corruption, insider trading, and the loss of trust if government officials stand to profit by placing bets on, say, the passage of certain legislation. Congress is already moving in bipartisan fashion on efforts to reduce those risks. As major prediction platforms exceed $6 billion in weekly trading volume, Congress is advancing legislation to curb insider trading by government officials and market professionals. The goal is to protect market integrity and public trust. The prediction markets are new, says Jill Fish, a business law professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. I think the public is going to be paying careful attention to how activities in the prediction markets can be abused or misused. The evidence of abuse is building quickly. In March, Beast Industries fired a staffer for using inside knowledge of its Mr. Beast YouTube contests to place successful bets on their outcomes in a prediction market called Kalshi. Kalshi had fined him $20,000, five times his initial winnings, and referred him to the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, CFTC. 2 weeks ago, Kalshi said it had fined and placed a five-year ban on three congressional candidates for betting on their own campaigns. Last week, in perhaps the most serious case to date, U.S. Army Special Forces Master Sergeant Gannon Ken Van Dyke pleaded not guilty to charges that he made $400,000 on Polymarket, another prediction market, by using classified information about a mission he was involved in. He's alleged to have wagered that the U.S. would remove Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from office just hours before the event happened. His trial is scheduled to begin in June. Bipartisan congressional reaction has been swift. On Thursday, the U.S. Senate voted unanimously to bar its members and staffers from placing bets with prediction markets. The same day, a group of Democratic senators and congressmen sent a letter to the CFTC urging it to reverse the rapid erosion of integrity in those betting markets. And Senators Kristen Gillibrand, a New York Democrat, and David McCormick, a Republican from Pennsylvania, introduced a bill in May 1st that would extend the prohibition to members of the House, the president, vice president, and senior executive branch officials. The Trump administration has meanwhile taken a friendly stance towards the betting markets. President Donald Trump has long touted a deregulatory philosophy and pushed for more aggressive economic competition, particularly in energy, financial services, and technology. Donald Trump Jr. is a strategic advisor to Kalshi and an investor in Polymarket. Trump Media has entered into partnerships to integrate prediction market features into its Truth Social Pro platform. The CFTC has sued several states that have tried to use their own illegal gambling measures to shut down prediction markets. The commission just wrapped up a public comment period in its own process to tighten prediction market rules. A previous iteration of prediction markets, known as Intrade, shut down after the CFTC, under President Barack Obama, sued it for allowing Americans to trade unregulated commodity options. An option is a contract that gives someone the opportunity, but not the obligation, to buy or sell something. The market shut down a year later. That's unlikely to happen under President Trump, says Robin Hanson, an economics professor at George Mason University and an early and prominent champion of prediction markets. At the moment, I think the Trump administration is pretty supportive. Nevertheless, the CFTC head, Michael Selig, has not minced words when it comes to combating insider trading. We have a zero-tolerance policy when it comes to fraud, manipulation, and insider trading, he told the House Agriculture Committee last month. We cannot, for the sake of the American people, slow down in our rulemaking. Policymakers have proposed various solutions to prevent insider trading and influence peddling, short of shutting down markets entirely. These include everything from capping trades to barring certain types of trades, such as bets on election or war outcomes. Kalshi and the poly market have made moves on their own to discourage questionable activity. Existing laws can address much in the egregious insider trading, as seen in the case against Sergeant Van Dyke. That case is novel because it marks the first time the Department of Justice has filed insider trading charges involving a prediction market. But existing law is clear, said Professor Fish at the University of Pennsylvania. Non-public information belongs to the government, she says, and if you take it for your personal use to make money, you violated the law. Many policymakers are hesitant to ban prediction markets entirely, because they can provide useful signals to the public, including companies and policymakers. Research shows that markets can be more accurate than polls at times and respond more quickly to shifts in events. In some cases, such as the direction of inflation or the growth of the economy, prediction markets are unmatched, says Jonathan Wright, an economics professor at Johns Hopkins University and co-author of a recent study on prediction markets. By having voters put their money or prediction bets where their mouths are, some companies say they can get a better sense of whether they should release a product, for example, or make a CEO change. The premise is that people make more careful predictions when the accuracy of their prediction means winning or losing money. Professor Hansen believes that in the future, prediction markets will help voters choose candidates by betting on what will happen if that candidate wins. Similarly, presidents might act differently if, for example, a prediction market gauged the economic consequences of an attack on Iran or big tariffs on other countries. There's a huge potential in the future for these markets just doing a lot more in society, says Professor Hansen. So what's the main reason to have a light touch in regulating them? Others are more skeptical, given the risk of manipulation and insider bets. There's no getting around the fact that any prediction market where somebody knows or controls the outcome of a bet is ripe for corruption, said Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut in a statement introducing the Bets Off Act in March. The act would ban all betting on government actions, terrorism, war, assassination, and on any events where a person knows or controls the outcome. Prediction markets are also an avenue by which government decisions get influenced by who's making money off them, and that should be unforgivable to the American public. Research shows that accuracy and responsiveness to the market's predictions come from a small minority of traders, on the order of 3%, according to a new study by researchers in London Business School and Yale University. It's those in-the-know traders who make the bulk of the profits, according to a new analysis published Sunday by the Wall Street Journal. A tiny sliver of accountants, 0.1%, takes home two-thirds of the profits. Still, prediction markets on economic subjects provide useful information, says Professor Wright of Johns Hopkins. It's the geopolitical bets that give him pause. That is just so fraught with questions of insider trading and potentially manipulation as well. And in politics, we have U.S. not giving an inch on immigration arrests, says Border Czar, by Sarah Mutzik, staff writer, Phoenix. President Donald Trump's Border Czar said Tuesday that the administration is hiring 10,000 new deportation officers to remove unauthorized immigrants from the U.S. interior, part of an ongoing hiring spree at the Department of Homeland Security. The move signals that even without the high-profile arrest and detention operations previously seen in U.S. cities, the mass deportation goal remains in place. The Trump administration is not giving an inch, Tom Hahnemann told a crowd at a border security conference and trade show in Phoenix. We're going to enforce the laws of this country without apology. After the fatal shootings of two U.S. citizens by Department of Homeland Security law enforcement in Minneapolis in January, the administration reined in what had become large-scale public immigration raids. But border officers have continued to assist Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, in the nation's interior. Rodney Scott, Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, CBP, recently confirmed to the Washington Examiner. That collaboration has continued with a relatively low profile, sparing the Trump administration protests and other disruptions related to those arrests. Even though high-profile immigration operations in U.S. cities have eased, President Donald Trump's border czar says the administration is hiring more deportation officers and will not back down. Border officers and agents are sending interview data within minutes to ICE special agents, Mr. Scott said Tuesday at the Border Security Expo. In many cases now, we're doing follow-up arrests at houses far away from the southwest border. ICE is based on the information they got 30 minutes, 2 hours ago from Border Patrol agents and CBP officers, he said. Mr. Hahnemann said the Trump administration, between ICE and the Border Patrol, has made some 800,000 removals. How exactly the government is calculating that removal count is unclear, as it has not been providing detailed regular reports on how it counts deportations. As a result, the public, journalists, and researchers cannot verify the accuracy of certain immigration enforcement numbers. The administration and some of its supporters have aimed for 1 million deportations a year. Mass deportations are coming, and criminals, public safety threats, and national security threats must be prioritized, Mr. Hahnemann said. At the same time, he reaffirmed the policy of detaining unauthorized immigrants encountered during operations. I don't care how long you've been here, Mr. Hahnemann said. Mr. Hahnemann, who began his federal career as a Border Patrol agent in the 1980s, has long made a humanitarian case for tighter border security. Deterring illegal crossings means fewer migrant deaths and less abuse of women and children along the way, he's argued. Immigration advocates counter that hardline and militarized border enforcement pushes border crossers into more remote and dangerous areas. After record-high illegal border crossings during the Biden administration, the southern border has never been more secure than it is now, Mr. Hahnemann said. Individuals are now returned, or detained rather than released, into the country to await court dates. The media want to say our policy is inhumane. We're cruel, said Mr. Hahnemann. No, we're saving thousands of lives. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. Now back to the next article. From the Americas, we have How Colombia Became a Top Exporter of Mercenaries by Manuel Rueda, contributor, Bogota, Colombia. As a sergeant in Colombia's army, Michael Ramirez fought in repeated battles against the nation's rebel groups. He learned how to fabricate explosives and was trained as a counterinsurgency specialist in a course that involved 40-mile marches and surviving in the jungle without food. Mr. Ramirez retired from service in 2015, but he missed military life, so 8 years later, he got on a plane to Europe to join the Ukrainian army. He always spoke about how he regretted retiring in his 30s and wanted to return to that world he knew so well, says his wife Patricia Mondiglano in Bogota. Every year, Colombia retires thousands of battle-hardened veterans from its armed forces. Many end up in enlisting in foreign conflicts, including the front lines of Ukraine. Over the past decade, Colombia has become a notorious supplier of mercenaries, with a March report published by the United Nations Working Group estimating that at least 10,000 Colombians have been recruited by foreign armies and security contractors around the world. In recent years, hundreds have wound up in Ukraine. The pull towards the war in Europe varies. Some have struggled to adapt to a sedentary life after the armed forces, while others complain about low pensions and few civilian job opportunities. NATO allies are often happy to bolster their forces with fighters from Colombia, where decades of internal conflicts involving guerrilla groups and drug traffickers have given many soldiers direct combat skills. Many veterans have received thorough training, sometimes from U.S. military advisors. Compared with the deceptive practices Russia employs in countries like Kenya and Nepal, Ukraine's recruitment of Colombian fighters appears to be largely above board. But the risks Colombians face in the front line are the same, as is the difficult search for closure for families of soldiers killed thousands of miles away from home in wars that have little to do with them. A UN convention against the use of mercenaries, created in 1989, says that hiring soldiers of fortune is illegal. It calls on signatories, of which there are fewer than 40, to prosecute mercenaries in their territory. Yet, the convention allows millions to integrate foreigners into their armies as long as they are treated the same as local fighters, with similar pay and obligations. This is what's happening in Ukraine and in other countries that have established foreign legions. Elizabeth Dickinson, a Colombia expert with the International Crisis Group, says the United Arab Emirates has been recruiting Colombian veterans since the early 2010s, when the Gulf nation was looking to bulk up its military with more mid-level officers. They narrowed in on Colombia, as many countries have since, because its officers were comfortable with the weapons and tactics used by NATO partners and other United States allies. Ms. Dickinson says that in recent years, a small industry of recruiters has developed within Colombia. Often retired officers themselves, the recruiters connect Colombian veterans with armies and security companies around the world. You have very official above-the-table and transparent recruitment, Ms. Dickinson says, but you also have an increasing number of Colombians who are recruited by deceptive middlemen and are not told what they're going getting themselves into. Backdoor recruits have fought for irregular forces in Sudan and Mexico. In 2021, a group of 26 Colombians was contracted by a company in Florida to take out, for the co-owner's financial benefit, Haiti's President Jovenel Moise. Some have wound up in Russia too, though it is far less frequent for Colombians to join the Russian army. Carlos Ramirez, a lawyer with a Colombian nonprofit called The Voices of Those Who Aren't Here, Corporación La Voz de los Que No Están, says that over the past 2 years, his organization has assisted 26 families with relatives who have joined the Russian army and are now missing or killed in action. During the same time period, his organization has helped more than 300 families whose relatives have gone to Ukraine and experienced a similar fate. Russia provides very few details about its fighters, said Mr. Ramirez. For any group or nation looking for a skilled fighter, Colombia offers a large supply of highly trained and relatively young veterans for a price. Under Colombian law, most soldiers are non-commissioned officers, and non-commissioned officers must retire at the age of 45, but many are let go by their commanders before that, when they have completed 20 years of service and are eligible for a pension. It's a way to keep forces young and physically fit in a country where troops are exposed to repeated combat. Others choose to retire young due to a lack of promotions or low pay. This means that those who begin their military careers right out of high school can receive retirement orders in their late 30s. At that age, many people still have to support their children or help their families, said Raul Muse Penku, president of ACOSIPAR, an association representing Colombia's retired soldiers. Veterans get a pension that is equivalent to 70% of what they last earned, Mr. Muse says, which typically comes to around $700 a month. Civilian employment opportunities are limited for someone who has been a soldier their entire career, he says. Those serving on the front lines in Ukraine, on the other hand, are offered around $4,000 a month. Ms. Mandangiano's husband was doing okay financially in Colombia, running a small business that sold car batteries. But with the wages from fighting abroad, he could start to pay off a home loan. For 5 months, he contemplated the move. Talking with other veterans in Colombia, watching social media accounts of compatriots fighting in Ukraine, discussing the risks with his family before ultimately buying a plane ticket to Europe. Once there, he participated in multiple raids on Russian positions in northern Ukraine, which he recorded with a body camera. In September of 2024, he got trapped during an operation near the village of Halburg and sought shelter in an abandoned truck. The Ukrainian army used a drone for 3 days to send him food, his wife recalls. They monitored him with heat cameras for a week, but then they lost track of him. Mr. Ramirez was reported missing, and his wife fears he could be dead or taken prisoner by the Russian military. Increasingly, Colombians with next to no military experience are enlisting in wars abroad, too. Edgar Eduardo Lopez enlisted in the Ukrainian Army in September of 2024. Although Mr. Lopez had completed a year of compulsory military service when he was 19, he hadn't picked up a gun in 2 decades. He'd spent the past several years working as a truck driver, earning slightly above Colombia's minimum wage of $500 a month. He told me he wanted to buy me a nice house, said his mother, Lucia Sanez, who lives in a hillside slum on the outskirts of Bogota. His lack of recent experience didn't stop the Ukrainian army from hiring him. While military experience increases the chances of acceptance, according to the Ukrainian International Legion's website, any 18 to 60-year-old in good health and without a criminal record is eligible. Mr. Lopez was killed in a battle with Russian forces in November of 2024, just 2 months after enlisting. Ms. Sanyas visited Ukraine last year to try to recover her son's remains, but was told his body was in an area now under Russian control and couldn't be reached. All she wants now is to give him a proper funeral, Mrs. Sanya says. He was my son, and I raised him on my own. Colombia's government says it wants to crack down on middlemen, trying to recruit mercenaries for foreign conflicts. President Gustavo Petro recently signed a law that confirms Colombia's accession into the UN Convention Against Mercenaries. But Colombian regulations need to go further, says Mario Unieta, a professor at Bogota's Rosario University who researches Colombia's mercenary industry. He'd like to see legally binding penalties for recruiters hiring fighters here, as well as training and mental health programs to help veterans transition into civilian life. In Colombia, we applaud our soldiers, and we call them heroes, said Mr. Urania. But he adds, that appreciation needs to extend beyond retirement. And the next article is from Africa. Why the price of Senegal's national dish just keeps going up? By Adrian Marot, contributor. Dakar, Senegal. The sun slowly begins to set over the island of Ngor, off the northern coast of Senegal's capital, Dakar, as residents and tourists lounge on the beach. The smell of frying fish wafts from a nearby restaurant, mingling with the salty air inside. Aminata Mbengu slices onions with quick, confident movements. On tonight's menu is Thieboudien, Senegal's national dish. It's made from fish, rice, cabbage, carrots, cassava, eggplant, oil, and chili. All of it stewed in a rich tomato-based broth. Traditionally eaten with one's hands from a communal plate, Thieb is seen as a culinary reflection of one of Senegal's core cultural values, tiringa, or hospitality. The cost of food is rising quickly in Senegal. Nowhere is this more evident than the price of the country's national dish, Thieboudien. The dish is so iconically Senegalese that in 2021, UNESCO added it to the list of the world's most important pieces of intangible cultural heritage. But nearly all of the ingredients Mrs. Mbengu adds to her pot tonight are shaped by the forest far beyond the country's borders. Right now, that means one thing, her costs are rising. As in other nations around the world, Senegal's government has expressed concerns about cost of living because of the war in Iran. Food inflation here predates that conflict, with local challenges ranging from the overfishing to raising imports. But war could exacerbate it further. Everything has gone up in Senegal, she says. Thieboudien's name comes from the Wolof words for its two core ingredients, sieb, that's C-E-B, rice, and djinn, fish. Traditionally, the djinn is a flaky white grouper, a type of fish known locally as thiof. But in recent years, overfishing by locals, coupled with added pressure from foreign industrial fleets, have begun to empty Senegalese waters of thiof. El Hadaj Mustafa Diop, a fisher since 1977, says he barely ever sees thiof in the water anymore. 10 years ago, and one day you could catch 15 or 20, he says. As a result of the shortage, many Thieb chefs have turned to a fish once associated with poverty, sardinella, or young sardines, but even they are becoming scarce. Mostly foreign-owned fish meal factories are driving a massive reduction in the population. In the 2010s, between 100,000 and 250,000 tons a sardinella were caught each year. But since 2020, catches have plummeted to approximately 10,000 tons annually. Scientists say the population is now teetering on the brink of collapse, meaning the fish population could soon be too low to replenish itself. Then there is the sieb, rice. Though it is a Senegalese staple, at least 40% of the country's supply is imported. Between 2020 and 2024, the price shot up nearly 40%, driven by global shocks, including the COVID-19 pandemic, rising shipping costs, and export restrictions from major rice-producing countries such as India. The government introduced subsidies to reduce the prices in 2024, but the reductions are unevenly applied, so many Senegalese are still paying more for rice than before the crisis. At Dakar's neighborhood Thieb eateries, rising costs are evident. 5 to 10 years ago, Thieb was the most affordable meal, says Ibrahima Fall, a mechanic. On a certain afternoon, he was sharing a communal plate of Thieb with his colleagues at an informal restaurant in the neighborhood of Virage. The chef here raised the price 3 years ago from 600 CFA francs, about a dollar, to 1,000, $1.80. And in Gore, at the same moment, Ms. Mbengu began charging 2,500 CFA francs, $4.50 for a plate instead of 1,500, $2.70 a plate. Now, I think twice before buying it, said Mr. Fall. Sometimes I choose a sandwich instead. For chefs, however, there is little that can be done. People think we raise prices to earn more, says Fatou Sarr, who makes Thieboudien on the central Dakar neighborhood of Oukam, but it's just to survive. Even the prices of locally grown veggies in Thebes aren't stable. They fluctuate with harvest quality, transport costs, and demand. Shopping for ingredients on the island of Ngor on a recent morning, Ms. Mgengu picked up a cabbage. 5 years ago, one cabbage was 100 CFA francs. Now it's more than double, at 250 CFA francs. Chilies, tomatoes, peppers, they're all up too, she says. Still, she has customers to serve. Back at the restaurant later in the day, she lifts the lid of the pot where her Thebe is cooking. A thick steam rises, filled with the smells of fish, onions, and chilies. The rice has turned a deep red. Ms. Mgengu dishes the first plates as more customers queue up to order. With practiced hands, she lays the fish gently on a bed of rice, stained deep red by the tomato sauce, then arranges the vegetables around it. A piece of carrot, a wedge of cabbage, a strip of cassava. A spoon of sauce follows, soaking into the grains. The dish might be more expensive than ever, but good thebenye is still hard to refuse. Indian nonprofits promote a culture of reuse for wedding celebrations. By Safina Nabi, contributor, New Delhi. Anu Praya Kumari always dreamed of wearing a wedding dress, like the bright, ornately embroidered one she saw on social media. But she knew that buying such a dress would stretch the limited savings of her farming family in India's eastern Bihar state. Then a local volunteer for the New Delhi-based nonprofit, Goonj, G-O-O-N-J, reached out to the family about its free wedding kits, which provide garments and other wedding items assembled from donated materials. Instead of buying new clothes that would likely be worn only once, Ms. Kumari decided to use one of Goonj's kits for her wedding last November. It had nearly everything needed for a bride's big day, including an elaborate red dress, several saris, a pair of sandals, cosmetics, and jewelry. I was very happy when I saw the dress, Ms. Kumari says, speaking over the phone from her village, Jamata. We would never have been able to afford something so beautiful. From reworn bridal dresses to recycled wedding favors, New Delhi-based groups help couples honor both tradition and the environment on their big day. Goonj is one of the at least two nonprofits based in the Indian capital, aimed at helping couples rethink extravagant weddings with single-use items. Founded in 1999 by Anshu Gupta, Goonj collects wedding clothes used mainly in urban centers and redistributes them through community-led programs, mostly across rural India. Local volunteers identify engaged couples and discuss options for lower cost and more environmentally friendly weddings that still honor tradition. In India, there are three things people can make larger than life and spend their entire earnings or savings on: weddings, rituals after a death, and the family, and building a house, says Mr. Gupta. With the wedding kits, we aim to promote sustainability and help families avoid falling into debt. Over time, we also saw a change of heart as people began making more conscious choices. More than 10 million weddings take place each year in India, the most in the world. Natural fiber textiles behave like organic waste and can generate methane in landfills under anaerobic conditions, says Shobha Vajiner, the founder of Sampurna, a New Delhi-based non-governmental organization. Large-scale disposal events like weddings may significantly add to this burden. India accounts for 8.5% of global textile waste, generating an estimated 7.8 million metric tons annually. About half comes from discarded clothing and household textiles. Sampurna collects wedding fabrics and textiles used in religious rituals and repurposes them into handcrafted items, including tablecloths, jackets, wall hangings, and seat cushion covers. The group also uses the collected material to make potless, elegant, reusable bags that contain wedding favors to distribute to guests or even serve as wedding gifts. Ms. Fijander says the potless have been popular. Most of the proceeds from the modest cost that Sampoorna charges, from 50 cents to $1 per bag, go to women from marginalized Indian communities who create and stitch the bags. Both Gunj and Sampoorna have evolved over the years. Gunj began primarily as a clothing redistribution effort, as volunteers encountered families struggling with the financial and social expectations for marriage ceremonies. The organization gradually expanded its work to include the wedding kits. Sampoorna's gift bag initiative emerged more recently with a similar concern about the environmental costs of modern weddings. Gunj says it has repurposed more than 72 million kilograms, that's 72,000 metric tons, of donated material since 2014. Since 2023 alone, the organization has distributed more than 800 wedding kits for brides from low-income families. Those who received the kits initially kept them, but Gunj's local volunteers now work to recirculate them. Meanwhile, Sampoorna has produced more than 6,000 items since 2023 that gave once-worn bridal and ceremonial textiles a second life. Together, the efforts suggest a small but growing shift towards weddings supported by reuse rather than new consumption. According to Anita Patel, who manages a nationwide network of partners, NGOs, for Gunj. Karthik Natarajan, an architect and textile product designer who has worked for more than two decades on sustainability initiatives in India and Germany, says Gunj's and Sampoorna's initiatives send a message to younger generations. In many parts of India and South Asia, wedding garments and household items were traditionally passed down through families, from mothers to daughters and granddaughters, he notes. Fast fashion gradually pushed that culture aside, but efforts like these are helping revive that legacy of sharing and reuse. Arvindi Charpota, a farmer in northwestern Rajasthan state, had imagined a grand wedding, including an embroidered outfit for himself with well-made shoes and headgear. But after a local Gunj volunteer pointed out that spending his savings on a single day could leave him and his bride struggling, Mr. Charpota requested a wedding kit. To my surprise, the kit was beautiful, he says, speaking by phone from the city of Banswara. I am glad I changed my decision. It helped me save money, and I still got to wear something even better than I had imagined. Wedding photographs show Mr. Charpota in a fine yellow suit with pink and yellow headwear and black shoes. His hands are adorned with henna. I have encouraged two more grooms to use my attire, and I will continue doing so, he says. It's not only conscious spending, but also good for the planet. And here is an editorial from the Monitor's View. Forest bump, fewer trees being felled. Encouraging data on deforestation rates points to a shift towards less alarmism, more collaboration, and community listening. By the Monitor's editorial board. New data on global deforestation has the potential to infuse a breath of fresh air into conservation efforts with the world's ongoing quest to balance environmental and economic priorities. Findings released this week from the University of Maryland's Global Land Analysis and Discovery Laboratory show that the rate of tree loss worldwide went down by 14% from 2024 to 2025. More significantly, deforestation in tropical rainforests, which help regulate weather by absorbing carbon and releasing water vapor and oxygen, plummeted by 36%. Improved governance, recognition of indigenous land rights, and corporate commitments help spur these achievements in countries such as Brazil, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Colombia, noted the World Resources Institute. While the advocacy group and other environmental experts caution against reading too much into what may be a one-year lull, signs of progress are present. Recent years have seen more countries engaging in measured policymaking and enforcement efforts, pursuing private and public sector cooperation, broadening civic engagement and participation of indigenous peoples, and using technology such as satellite imagery to monitor performance. In addition, sophisticated financial instruments are also being used to incentivize forest protection. This includes the Tropical Forests Forever Facility, launched last November to target investment capital and to countries maintaining low levels of deforestation. These trends of thought and practice indicate a shift away from what climate change critics have called alarmist or exaggerated tactics to more considered conversations that acknowledge both the ecological and economic value of forest resources. When it comes to the Amazon, which makes up one-fifth of the world's forests, its services are immensely valuable, The Economist pointed out in last October. Treating its carbon storage, water regulation, and biodiversity as services rendered rather than free gifts would make its preservation economically rational. Conserving this resource, it said, requires creativity, diplomacy, and clear-sightedness. Such clarity can also be supported by a regular, greater degree of humility and readiness to go beyond expert opinions and learn from local communities and from nature itself. For instance, studies show that collaborative community-based forest management can reduce tree cover loss by 55% to 66% compared with areas overseen by government staff alone. And in early April, scientists expressed surprise and delight at what they discovered about nature's rapid resilience. In the course of a four-year study of deforested areas in Ecuador, they found that complex ecosystems can recover in a few years or decades, rather than the century or more that they had previously believed necessary. The challenges of continued rainforest loss remain serious and extensive. Population and economic pressures are often compounded by corruption, poverty, and inefficiency in many countries. But as the quality of governance, scientific inquiry, and democratic participation improve, so too can principled stewardship of the world's natural treasures. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona.